Ed and Helen Deepnow lived in a small Cape Cod, chocolate brown, whipped cream trim, the kind of house which older women often call darling, four houses up from the one Ralph and Bill McGovern shared. Carolyn had liked to say the Deepnows belonged to the Church of the Latter-day Yuppies, although her genuine liking for them had robbed the phrase of any real bite. They were laissez-faire vegetarians who considered both fish and dairy products okay. They'd worked for Clinton in the last election, and the car in the driveway, not a Datsun now, but one of the new minivans, was wearing bumper stickers which said, "Split wood, not atoms," and "Fur on animals, not people." The Deepnows had also apparently kept every album they had ever purchased during the 60s. Carolyn had found this one of their most endearing characteristics. And now, as Ralph approached the Cape Cod with his hands curled into fists at his sides, he heard Grace Slick wailing one of those old San Francisco anthems. "One pill makes you bigger, one pill makes you small, and the ones that Mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall." The music was coming from a boombox on the Cape Cod's postage-stamp-sized porch. A sprinkler twirled on the lawn, making a shh, shh, shh sound as it cast rainbows in the air and deposited a shiny wet patch on the sidewalk. Ed Deepnow, shirtless, was sitting in a lawn chair to the left of the concrete walk with his legs crossed, looking up at the sky with the bemused expression of a man trying to decide if the cloud passing overhead looks more like a horse or a unicorn. One bare foot bopped up and down in time to the music. The book lying open and face down in his lap went perfectly with the music pouring from the boombox. "Even Cowgirls Get the Blues" by Tom Robbins. An all but perfect summer vignette, a scene of small-town serenity Norman Rockwell might have painted and then titled "Afternoon Off." All you had to overlook was the blood on Ed's knuckles and the drop on the left lens of his round John Lennon specs. "Ralph, for God's sake, don't get into a fight with him," McGovern hissed as Ralph left the sidewalk and cut across the lawn. He walked through the lawn sprinkler's fine cold spray almost without feeling it. Ed turned, saw him, and broke into a sunny grin. "Hey, Ralph," he said. "Good to see you, man." In his mind's eye, Ralph saw himself reaching out and shoving Ed's chair, pushing him over and spilling him onto his lawn. He saw Ed's eyes widen with shock and surprise behind the lenses of his glasses. This vision was so real, he even saw the way the sun reflected on the face of Ed's watch as he tried to sit up. "Grab yourself a beer and drag up a rock," Ed was saying, "if you feel like a game of chess." "Beer? A game of chess? Christ Jesus, Ed, what's wrong with you?" Ed didn't answer immediately, only looked at Ralph with an expression that was both frightening and infuriating. It was a mixture of amusement and shame. The look of a man who's getting ready to say, "Ah, shit, honey, did I forget to put out the trash again?" Ralph pointed down the hill, past McGovern, who was standing. He would have been lurking if there'd been something to lurk behind, near the wet patch the sprinkler had put on the sidewalk, watching them nervously. The first police car had been joined by a second, and Ralph could faintly hear the crackle of radio calls through the open windows. The crowd had gotten quite a bit bigger. "The police are there because of Helen," he said, telling himself not to shout. It would do no good to shout, and shouting anyway. "They're there because you beat up your wife. Is that getting through to you?" "Oh," Ed said, and rubbed his cheek ruefully. "That?" "Yes, that," Ralph said. He now felt almost stupefied with rage. Ed peered past him at the police cars, at the crowd standing around the Red Apple, and then he saw McGovern. "Bill," he cried. McGovern recoiled. Ed either didn't notice or pretended not to. "Hey, man, drag up a rock. Want a beer?" That was when Ralph knew he was going to hit Ed, break his stupid little round-lensed spectacles, drive a splinter of glass into his eye, maybe. He was going to do it. Nothing on earth could stop him from doing it. Except at the last moment, something did. It was Carolyn's voice he heard inside his head most frequently these days. When he wasn't just muttering along to himself, that was. But this wasn't Carolyn's voice. This one, as unlikely as it seemed, belonged to Trigger Vachon, whom he'd only seen once or twice since the day Trigger had saved him from the thunderstorm, the day Carolyn had had her first seizure.
Aye, Ralph, be damn careful, you. This one crazy like a fox. Maybe he wanted you to hit him.
Yes, he decided. Maybe that was just what Ed wanted.
Why? Who knew?
Maybe to muddy the waters up a little bit. Maybe just because he was crazy. Cut the shit, he said, dropping his voice almost to a whisper. He was gratified to see Ed's attention snap back to him in a hurry, and even more pleased to see Ed's pleasantly vague expression of rueful amusement disappear. It was replaced by a narrow, watchful expression. It was, Ralph thought, the look of a dangerous animal with its wind up. Ralph hunkered down so he could look directly at Ed. Was it Susan Day, he asked in the same soft voice? Susan Day and the abortion business? Something about dead babies? Is that why you unloaded on Helen? There was another question on his mind. Who are you really, Ed? But before he could ask it, Ed reached out, placed a hand in the center of Ralph's chest, and pushed. Ralph fell backward onto the damp grass, catching himself on his elbows and shoulders. He lay there with his feet flat on the ground and his knees up, watching as Ed suddenly sprang out of his lawn chair. Ralph, don't mess with him, McGovern called from his place of relative safety on the sidewalk. Ralph paid no attention. He simply remained where he was, propped on his elbows and looking attentively up at Ed. He was still angry and afraid, but these emotions had begun to be overshadowed by a strange, chilly fascination. This was madness he was looking at. The genuine article. No comic book supervillain here. No Norman Bates. No Captain Ahab. It was just Ed Deepnow who worked down the coast at Hawking Labs. One of those eggheads, the old guys who played chess at the picnic area out on the extension would have said. But still a nice enough fella for a Democrat. Now the nice enough fella had gone mad, totally bonkers, and it hadn't just happened this afternoon when Ed had seen his wife's name on a petition hanging from the community bulletin board in Shores. Ralph now understood that Ed's madness was at least a year old, and that made him wonder what secrets Helen had been keeping behind her normal, cheery demeanor and sunny smile, and what small, desperate signals, beside the bruises, that was, he might have missed. And then there's Natalie, he thought. What's she seen? What's she experienced? Besides, of course, being carried across Harris Avenue and the Red Apple parking lot on her staggering, bleeding mother's hip. Ralph's arms broke out in goosebumps. Ed had begun to pace, meanwhile, crossing and recrossing the cement path, trampling the zinnias Helen had planted along it as a border. He had returned to the Ed Ralph had encountered out by the airport the year before, right down to the fierce little pokes of the head and the sharp, jabbing glances at nothing. This is what the Gee Whiz Act was supposed to hide, Ralph thought. He looks the same now as he did when he took after the guy driving that pickup truck, like a rooster protecting his little piece of the barnyard. None of this is strictly her fault, I admit that, Ed spoke rapidly, pounding his right fist into his open left palm as he walked through the cloud of spray thrown by the sprinkler. Ralph realized he could see every rib in Ed's chest. The man looked as if he hadn't had a decent meal in months. Still, once stupidity reaches a certain level, it becomes hard to live with, Ed went on. She's like the Magi, actually coming to King Herod for information. I mean, how dumb can you get? Where is he that is born king of the Jews? To Herod they say this. I mean, wise men my ass. Right, Ralph? Ralph nodded. Sure, Ed. Whatever you say, Ed. Ed returned the nod and went on tramping back and forth through the spray and the ghostly interlocking rainbows, smacking his fist into his palm. It's like that Rolling Stones song. Look at that! Look at that! Look at that stupid girl! You probably don't remember that one, do you? Ed laughed, a jagged little sound that made Ralph think of rats dancing on broken glass. McGovern knelt beside him. Let's get out of here, he muttered. Ralph shook his head, and when Ed swung back in their direction, McGovern quickly got up and retreated to the sidewalk again. She thought she could fool you, is that it? Ralph asked. He was still lying on the lawn, propped up on his elbows. She thought you wouldn't find out she signed the petition. Ed leaped over the walk, bent over Ralph, and shook his clenched fists over his head like the bad guy in a silent movie. No, 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 he cried.
The Jefferson airplane had been replaced by the animals, Eric Burdon growling out the gospel according to John Lee Hooker. Boom, 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 boom. Gonna shoot you right down. McGovern uttered a thin cry, apparently thinking Ed meant to attack Ralph. But instead, Ed sank down with the knuckles of his left hand pressed into the grass, assuming the position of a sprinter who waits for the starter's gun to explode him out of the blocks. His face was covered with beads of what Ralph at first took for sweat before remembering the way Ed had paced back and forth through the spray from the sprinkler. Ralph kept looking at the spot of blood on the left lens of Ed's glasses. It had smeared a little, and now the pupil of his left eye looked as if it had filled up with blood. Finding out that she signed the petition was fate. Simple fate. Do you mean to tell me you don't see that? Don't insult my intelligence, Ralph. You may be getting on in years, but you're far from stupid. The thing is, I go down to the supermarket to buy Simulac, baby formula. How's that for irony? And find out she signed on with the baby killers, the Centurions, with the Crimson King himself. And you know what? I just saw red. The Crimson King, Ed? Who's he? Oh, please. Ed gave Ralph a cunning look. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and in all the coasts thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. It's in the Bible, Ralph, in good King James, Matthew, chapter 2, verse 16. Do you doubt it? Do you have any fucking question that it says that? No, if you say so, I believe it. Ed nodded, his eyes a deep and startling shade of green, darted here and there. Then he slowly leaned forward over Ralph, planting one hand on either side of Ralph's arms. It was as if he meant to kiss him. Ralph could smell sweat and some sort of aftershave that had almost completely faded away now, and something else. Something that smelled like old curdled milk. He wondered if it might be the smell of Ed's madness. An ambulance was coming up Harris Avenue, running its flashes but not its siren. It turned into the Red Apple's parking lot. You better, Ed breathed into his face. You just better believe it. His eyes stopped wandering and centered on Ralph's. They are killing the babies wholesale, he said in a low voice, which was not quite steady, ripping them from the wombs of their mothers and carrying them out of town in covered trucks, flatbeds for the most part. Ask yourself this, Ralph. How many times a week do you see one of those big flatbeds tooling down the road? A flatbed with a tarp stretched over the back. Ever ask yourself what those trucks were carrying? Ever wonder what was under most of those tarps? Ed grinned. His eyes rolled. They burn most of the fetuses over in Newport. The sign says landfill, but it's really a crematorium. They send some of them out of state, though, in trucks, in light planes, because fetal tissue is extremely valuable. I tell you that not just as a concerned citizen, Ralph, but as an employee of Hawking Laboratories. Fetal tissue is more valuable than gold. He turned his head suddenly and stared at Bill McGovern, who had crept a little closer again in order to hear what Ed was saying. Yea, more valuable than gold and more precious than rubies, he screamed. And McGovern leaped back, eyes widening in fear and dismay. Do you know that, you old faggot? Yes, McGovern said. I guess I did. He shot a quick glance down the street where one of the police cars was now backing out of the Red Apple lot and turning in their direction. I might have read it somewhere. In Scientific American, perhaps. Scientific American? Ed laughed with gentle contempt and rolled his eyes at Ralph again, as if to say, you see what I have to deal with? Then his face grew sober again. Wholesale murder, he said, just as in the time of Christ, only now it's the murder of the unborn. Not just here, but all over the world. They've been slaughtering them by their thousands, Ralph. By their millions. And do you know why? Do you know why we've re-entered the court of the Crimson King in this new age of darkness? Ralph knew. It wasn't that hard to put together if you had enough pieces to work with. If you had seen Ed with his arm buried in a barrel of chemical fertilizer, fishing around for the dead babies he'd been sure he would find. King Herod got a little advance word this time around, Ralph said. That's what you're telling me, isn't it? It's the old Messiah thing, right? He sat up, half expecting Ed to shove him down again, almost hoping he would. His anger was coming back. It was surely wrong to critique a madman's delusional fantasies the way he might a play or a movie, maybe even blasphemous. But Ralph found the idea that Helen had been beaten because of such hackneyed old shit as this infuriating. Ed didn't touch him, merely got to his feet and dusted his hands off in businesslike fashion. He seemed to be cooling down again. Radio calls crackled louder as the police cruiser, which had backed out of the Red Apples lot, now glided up to the curb. Ed looked at the cruiser, then back at Ralph, who was getting up himself. "You can mock, but it's true," he said quietly. "It's not King Herod, though. It's the Crimson King. Herod was merely one of his incarnations. The Crimson King jumps from body to body and generation to generation, like a kid using stepping stones to cross a brook, Ralph. Always looking for the Messiah. He's always missed him, but this time it could be different. Because Derry's different. All lines of force have begun to converge here. I know how difficult that is to believe, but it's true." The Crimson King, Ralph thought. Oh, Helen, I'm so sorry. What a sad thing this is. Two men, one in uniform, one in street clothes, both presumably cops, got out of the police car and approached McGovern. Behind them, down at the store, Ralph spotted two more men, these dressed in white pants and white short-sleeved shirts, coming out of the Red Apple. One had his arm around Helen, who was walking with the fragile care of a post-op patient. The other was holding Natalie. These two men, Ralph supposed they were paramedics, helped Helen into the back of the ambulance. The one with the baby got in after her while the other moved toward the driver's seat. What Ralph sensed in their movements was competency rather than urgency, and he thought that was good news for Helen. Maybe Ed hadn't hurt her too badly. This time, at least. The plainclothes cop, burly, broad-shouldered, and wearing his blonde mustache and sideburns in a style Ralph thought of as early American singles bar, had approached McGovern, whom he seemed to recognize. There was a big grin on the plainclothes cop's face. Ed put an arm over Ralph's shoulders and pulled him a few steps away from the men on the sidewalk. He also dropped his voice to a bare murmur. "I don't want them to hear us," he said. "Well, I'm sure you don't. These creatures, centurions, servants of the Crimson King, will stop at nothing. They are relentless." "I'll bet." Ralph glanced over his shoulder in time to see McGovern point at Ed. The burly man nodded calmly. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his chinos. He was still wearing a small, benign smile. "This isn't just about abortion. Don't get that idea. Not anymore. They're taking the unborn from all kinds of mothers, not just the junkies and the whores. 8 days, 8 weeks, 8 months. It's all the same to the centurions. The harvest goes on day and night. The slaughter. I've seen the corpses of infants on roofs, Ralph, under hedges. They're in the sewers, floating in the sewers, and in the Kenderskeeg down in the barrens." His eyes, huge and green, as bright as trumpery emeralds, stared off into the distance. "Ralph," he whispered, "sometimes the world is full of colors. I've seen them since he came and told me. But now all the colors are turning black." "Since who came and told you, Ed?" "We'll talk about it later," Ed replied, speaking out of the corner of his mouth like a con in a prison movie. Under other circumstances, it would have been funny. A big game show host grin dawned on his face, banishing the madness as convincingly as sunrise banishes night. The change was almost tropical in its suddenness, and creepy as hell, but Ralph found something comforting about it, just the same. Perhaps he, McGovern, Lois, all the others on this little stretch of Harris Avenue who knew Ed, would not have to blame themselves too much for not seeing his madness sooner, after all. Because Ed was good. Ed really had his act down. That grin was an Academy Award winner. Even in a bizarre situation like this, it practically demanded that you respond to it. Hey, hi, he told the two cops. The burly one had finished his conversation with McGovern, and both of them were advancing across the lawn. Drag up a rock, you guys. Ed stepped around Ralph with his hand held out. The burly plainclothes cop shook it, still smiling a small, benign smile. Edward Deepnow? He asked. Right. Ed shook hands with the uniformed cop, who looked a trifle bemused, and then returned his attention to the burly man. I'm Detective Sergeant John Laydecker, the burly man said. This is Officer Chris Nell. Understand you had a little trouble here, sir. Well, yes, I guess that's right. A little trouble. Or if you want to call a spade, I behaved like a horse's ass. Ed's embarrassed little chuckle was alarmingly normal. Ralph thought of all the charming psychopaths he'd seen in the movies. George Sanders had always been particularly good at that sort of role, and wondered if it was possible for a smart research chemist to snow a small city detective who looked as if he had never completely outgrown his Saturday night fever phase. Ralph was terribly afraid it might be. Helen and I got into an argument about a petition she'd signed, Ed was saying, and one thing just led to another. Man, I just can't believe I hit her. He flapped his arms as if to convey how flustered he was, not to mention confused and ashamed. Laydecker smiled in return. Ralph's mind returned to the confrontation last summer between Ed and the man in the blue pickup. Ed had called the heavy-set man a murderer, had even stroked him one across the face. And still the guy had ended up looking at Ed almost with respect. It had been like a kind of hypnosis, and Ralph thought he was seeing the same force at work here. Things just kind of got out of hand a little, is that what you're telling me? Laydecker asked sympathetically. Well, that's about the size of it, yeah. Ed had to be at least 35, but his wide eyes and innocent expression made him look barely old enough to buy beer. Wait a minute, Ralph blurted. You can't believe him. He's nuts and dangerous. He just told me... This is Mr. Roberts, right? Laydecker asked McGovern, ignoring Ralph completely. Yes, McGovern said, and to Ralph he sounded insufferably pompous. That is Ralph Roberts. Uh-huh. Laydecker at last looked at Ralph. I'll want to speak to you in a couple of minutes, Mr. Roberts, but for the time being I'd like you to stand over there beside your friend and keep quiet, okay? But, okay? Angrier than ever, Ralph stalked over to where McGovern was standing. This did not seem to upset Laydecker in the least. He turned to Officer Nell. You want to turn off the music, Chris, so we can hear ourselves think? Yo! The uniformed cop went to the boombox, inspected the various knobs and switches, then killed the Who halfway through the song about the blind pinball wizard. I guess I did have it cranked a little, Ed looked sheepish. Wonder the neighbors didn't complain. Oh, well, life goes on, Laydecker said. He tilted his small, serene smile up toward the clouds drifting across the blue summer sky. Wonderful, Ralph thought. This guy is a regular Will Rogers. Ed, however, was nodding as if the detective had produced not just a single pearl of wisdom, but a whole string of them. Laydecker rummaged in his pocket and came out with a little tube of toothpicks. He offered them to Ed, who declined, then shook one out and stuck it in the corner of his mouth. So, he said, little family argument, is that what I'm hearing? Ed nodded eagerly. He was still smiling his sincere, slightly puzzled smile. More of a discussion, actually, a political. Laydecker said, nodding and smiling. But before you go any further, Mr. Deepnow, Ed, please. Before we go any further, Mr. Deepnow, I just kind of want to tell you that anything you say could be used against you, you know, in a court of law. Also that you have a right to an attorney. Ed's friendly but puzzled smile, gosh, what did I do? Can you help me figure it out? Faltered for a moment. The narrow, appraising look replaced it. Ralph glanced at McGovern, and the relief he saw in Bill's eyes mirrored what he was feeling himself. Laydecker was maybe not such a hick after all. What in God's name would I want an attorney for? Ed asked. He made a half-turn and tried the puzzled smile out on Chris Nell, who was still standing beside the boombox on the porch steps. I don't know, and maybe you don't, Laydecker said, still smiling. I'm just telling you that you can have one, and that if you can't afford one,
The city of Derry will provide you with one.
But I don't... Laedeker was nodding and smiling. That's okay, sure, whatever.
But those are your rights. Do you understand your rights as I've explained them to you, Mr. Deepnow?
Ed stood stock still for a moment, his eyes suddenly wide and blank again. To Ralph, he looked like a human computer trying to process a huge and complicated wad of input. Then the fact that the snow job wasn't working seemed to get through to him. His shoulders sagged. The blankness was replaced by a look of unhappiness too real to doubt. But Ralph doubted it anyway. He had to doubt it. He'd seen the madness on Ed's face before Laedeker and Nell arrived. So had Bill McGovern. Yet doubt was not quite the same as disbelief, and Ralph had an idea that on some level, Ed honestly regretted beating Helen up.
Yes, he thought, just as on some level he honestly believes that these centurions of his are driving truckloads of fetuses out to the Newport landfill, and that the forces of good and evil are gathering in Derry to play out some drama that's going on in his mind. Call it Omen 5, in the court of the Crimson King.
Still, he could not help feeling a reluctant sympathy for Ed Deepnow, who had visited Carolyn faithfully 3 times a week during her final confinement at Derry Home, who always brought flowers and always kissed her on the cheek when he left. He had continued giving her that kiss even when the smell of death had begun to surround her, and Carolyn had never failed to clasp his hand and give him a smile of gratitude.
"Thank you for remembering that I'm still a human being," that smile had said. "And thank you for treating me like one." That was the Ed Ralph had thought of as his friend, and he thought, or maybe only hoped, that Ed was still in there.
"I'm in trouble here, aren't I?" he asked Laedeker softly.
"Well, let's see," Laedeker said, still smiling. "You knocked out 2 of your wife's teeth. Looks like you fractured her cheekbone. I bet you my grandfather's watch she's got a concussion. Plus selected short subjects, cuts, bruises, and this funny bare patch over her right temple. What'd you try to do, snatch her bald-headed?"
Ed was silent, his green eyes fixed on Laedeker's face.
"She's going to spend the night in the hospital under observation because some asshole pounded the hell out of her. And everybody seems in agreement that the asshole was you, Mr. Deepnow. I look at the blood on your hands and the blood on your glasses, and I gotta say, I also think it was probably you. So what do you think? You look like a bright guy. Do you think you're in trouble?"
"I'm very sorry I hit her," Ed said. "I didn't mean to."
"Uh-huh. And if I had a quarter for every time I've heard that, I'd never have to buy another drink out of my paycheck. I'm arresting you on a charge of second-degree assault, Mr. Deepnow, also known as domestic assault. This charge falls under Maine's domestic violence law. I'd like you to confirm once more that I've informed you of your rights."
"Yes," Ed spoke in a small, unhappy voice. The smile, puzzled or otherwise, was gone.
"We're going to take you down to the police station and book you," Laedeker said. "Following that, you can make a telephone call and arrange bail. Chris, put him in the car, would you?"
Nell approached Ed.
"Are you going to be a problem, Mr. Deepnow?"
"No," Ed said in that same small voice, and Ralph saw a tear slip from Ed's right eye. He wiped it away absently with the heel of his hand.
"No problem."
"Great," Nell said heartily, and walked with him to the cruiser. Ed glanced at Ralph as he crossed the sidewalk.
"I'm sorry, old boy," he said, then got into the back of the car. Before Officer Nell closed the door, Ralph saw there was no handle on the inside of it.
"Okay," Laedeker said, turning to Ralph and holding out his hand. "I'm sorry if I seemed a little brisk, Mr. Roberts, but sometimes these guys can be volatile. I especially worry about the ones who look sober, because you can never tell what they'll do. John Laedeker."
"I had Johnny as a student when I was teaching at the community college," McGovern said.
Now that Ed Deepnow was safely tucked away in the back of the cruiser, he sounded almost giddy with relief. "Good student. Did an excellent term paper on the Children's Crusade."
"It's a pleasure to meet you," Ralph said, shaking Lydecker's hand. "And don't worry, no offense taken."
You were insane to come up here and confront him, you know, Lydecker said cheerfully. I was pissed off. I'm still pissed off. I can understand that, but you got away with it. That's the important thing. No, Helen's the important thing. Helen and the baby. I can go with that. Tell me what you and Mr. Deepno talked about before we got up here, Mr. Roberts. Or can I call you Ralph? Ralph, please. He ran through his conversation with Ed, trying to keep it brief. McGovern, who had heard some of it, but not all of it, listened in round-eyed silence. Every time Ralph looked at him, he found himself wishing Bill had worn his Panama. He looked older without it, almost ancient. Well, that certainly sounds pretty weird, doesn't it? Lydecker remarked when Ralph had finished. What will happen? Will he go to jail? He shouldn't go to jail. He should be committed. Probably should be, Lydecker agreed. But there's a lot of distance between should be and will be. He won't go to jail, and he isn't going to be carted off to Sunnyvale Sanitarium either. That sort of thing only happens in old movies. The best we can hope for is some court-ordered therapy. But didn't Helen tell you... The lady didn't tell us anything, and we didn't try to question her in the store. She was in a lot of pain, both physical and emotional. Yes, of course she was, Ralph said. Stupid of me. She might corroborate your stuff later on, but she might not. Domestic abuse victims have a way of turning into clams, you know. Luckily, it doesn't really matter one way or the other under the new law. We got him nailed to the wall. You and the lady in the little store down the street can testify to Mrs. Deepnose's condition and to who she said put her in that condition. I can testify to the fact that the victim's husband had blood on his hands. Best of all, he said the magic words, "Man, I just can't believe I hit her." I'm going to come over, probably tomorrow morning, if that works for you, and take a complete statement from you, Ralph. But that's just filling in the blanks. Basically, this one's a done deal. Lydecker took the toothpick out of his mouth, broke it, tossed it in the gutter, and produced his tube again. Pick? No thanks, Ralph said, smiling faintly. Don't blame you. A lousy habit. But I'm trying to quit smoking, which is an even worse one. The thing about guys like Deepno is that they're too goddamn smart for their own good. They go over the high side, hurt someone, and then they pull back. If you get there soon enough after the blow-up, like you did, Ralph, you can almost see them standing there with their heads cocked, listening to the music, and trying to get back on the beat. That's just how it was, Ralph said. Exactly how it was. It's a trick the Bright Ones manage for quite a while. They appear remorseful, appalled by their own actions, determined to make amends. They're persuasive, they're charming, and it's often all but impossible to see that underneath the sugar coating they're as nutty as Christmas fruitcakes. Even extreme cases like Ted Bundy sometimes manage to look normal for years. The good news is that there aren't many guys like Ted Bundy out there, in spite of all the psycho killer books and movies. Ralph sighed deeply. What a mess. Yeah, but look on the bright side, Ralph. We're going to be able to keep him away from her, at least for a while. He'll be out by supper time on $25 bail, but $25? McGovern asked. He sounded simultaneously shocked and cynical. That's all? Yep, Lydecker said. I gave Deepno the second-degree assault stuff because it do sound fearsome. But in the state of Maine, lumping up your wife is only a misdemeanor. Still, there's a nifty new wrinkle in the law, Chris Nell said, joining them. If Deepno wants bail, he has to agree that he'll have absolutely no contact with his wife until the case is settled in court. He can't come to the house, approach her on the street, or even call her on the phone. If he doesn't agree, he sits in jail. Suppose he agrees and then comes back anyway, Ralph asked. Then we slam dunk him, Nell said, because that one is a felony, or can be, if the district attorney wants to play hardball. In any case, violators of the domestic violence bail agreement usually spend a lot more than just the afternoon in jail. And hopefully the spouse he breaks the agreement to visit will still be alive when he comes to trial, McGovern said. Yeah, Lydecker said heavily. Sometimes that's a problem. Ralph went home and sat staring not at the TV, but through it for an hour or so. He got up during a commercial to see if there was a cold Coke in the refrigerator, staggered on his feet, and had to put a hand on the wall to steady himself. He was trembling all over and felt unpleasantly close to vomiting. He understood that this was nothing but delayed reaction, but the weakness and nausea still frightened him. He sat down again, took a minute's worth of deep breaths with his head down and his eyes closed, then got up and walked slowly into the bathroom. He filled the tub with warm water and soaked until he heard Night Court, the first of the afternoon sitcoms, starting up on the TV in the living room. By then, the water in the tub had become almost chilly, and Ralph was glad to get out. He dried off, dressed in fresh clothes, and decided that a light supper was at least in the realm of possibility. He called downstairs, thinking McGovern might like to join him for a bite to eat, but there was no answer. Ralph put on water in which to boil a couple of eggs, and called Derry Home Hospital from the phone by the stove. His call was shunted to a woman in patient services, who checked a computer and told him yes, he was correct, Helen Deepnow had been admitted to the hospital. Her condition was listed as fair. No, she had no idea who was taking care of Mrs. Deepnow's baby. All she knew was that she did not have a Natalie Deepnow on her admissions list. No, Ralph could not visit Mrs. Deepnow that evening, but not because her doctor had established a no-visitors policy. Mrs. Deepnow had left that order herself. Why would she do that? Ralph started to ask, then didn't bother. The woman in patient services would probably tell him she was sorry. She didn't have that information in her computer. But Ralph decided he had it in his computer, the one between his giant economy-size ears. Helen didn't want visitors because she was ashamed. None of what had happened was her fault, but Ralph doubted if that changed the way she felt. She had been seen by half of Harris Avenue staggering around like a badly beaten boxer after the ref had stopped the fight. She had been taken to the hospital in an ambulance, and her husband, the father of her daughter, was responsible. Ralph hoped they would give her something that would help her sleep through the night. He had an idea things might look a little better to her in the morning. God knew they couldn't look much worse. Hell, I wish someone would give me something to help me sleep through the night, he thought. Then go see Dr. Litchfield, you idiot, another part of his mind responded immediately. The woman in patient services was asking Ralph if she could do anything else for him. Ralph said no and was starting to thank her when the line clicked in his ear. Nice, Ralph said, very nice. He hung up himself, got a tablespoon, and gently lowered his eggs into the water. 10 minutes later, as he was sitting down with the boiled eggs sliding around on a plate and looking like the world's biggest pearls, the phone rang. He put his supper on the table and grabbed it off the wall. Hello? Silence, broken only by breathing. Hello? Ralph repeated. There was one more breath, this one almost loud enough to be an aspirated sob, and then another click in his ear. Ralph hung the telephone up and stood looking at it for a moment, his frown putting three ascending wave lines on his brow. Come on, Helen, he said. Call me back, please. Then he returned to the table, sat down, and began to eat his small bachelor's supper. He was washing up his few dishes 15 minutes later when the phone rang again. That won't be her, he thought, wiping his hands on a dish towel and then flipping it over his shoulder as he went to the phone. No way it'll be her. It's probably Lois or Bill. But another part of him knew differently. Hi, Ralph. Hello, Helen. That was me a few minutes ago. Her voice was husky as if she'd been drinking or crying, and Ralph didn't think they allowed booze in the hospital. I kind of figured that. I heard your voice, and I couldn't... That's okay. I understand. Do you... She gave a long, watery sniff. I think so, yes. The nurse came by and gave me a pain pill. I can use it, too. My face really hurts. But I wouldn't let myself take it until I called you again and said what I had to say. Pain sucks, but it's a hell of an incentive. Helen, you don't have to say anything. But he was afraid that she did, and he was afraid of what it might be. Afraid of finding out that she had decided to be angry at him because she couldn't be angry with Ed. Yes, I do.
I have to say, thank you.
Ralph leaned against the side of the door and closed his eyes for a moment. He was relieved but unsure how to reply. He'd been ready to say, "I'm sorry you feel that way, Helen," in the calmest voice he could manage. That was how sure he'd been that she was going to start off by asking him why he couldn't mind his own business. And, as if she had read his mind and wanted to let him know he wasn't entirely off the hook, Helen said, "I spent most of the ride here and the check-in and the first hour or so in the room being terribly angry at you. I called Candy Shoemaker, my friend from over on Kansas Street, and she came and got Nat. She's keeping her for the night. She wanted to know what had happened, but I wouldn't tell her. I just wanted to lie here and be mad that you called 911, even though I told you not to. Helen, let me finish so I can take my pill and go to sleep, okay?" "Okay." "Just after Candy left with the baby. Nat didn't cry, thank God. I don't know if I could have handled that. A woman came in. At first I thought she must have gotten the wrong room because I didn't know her from Eve. And when I got it through my head that she was here to see me, I told her I didn't want any visitors. She didn't pay any attention. She closed the door and lifted her skirt up so I could see her left thigh. There was a deep scar running down it, almost all the way from her hip to her knee. She said her name was Gretchen Tilbury, that she was a family abuse counselor at Woman Care, and that her husband had cut her leg open with a kitchen knife in 1978. She said if the man in the downstairs apartment hadn't gotten a tourniquet on it, she would have bled to death. I said I was very sorry to hear that, but I didn't want to talk about my own situation until I'd had a chance to think it over." Helen paused and then said, "But that was a lie, you know. I've had plenty of time to think it over, because Ed first hit me 2 years ago, long before I got pregnant with Nat. I just kept pushing it away." "I can see how a person would do that," Ralph said. "This lady, well, they must give people like her lessons on how to get through people's defenses." Ralph smiled. "I believe that's about half their training. She said I couldn't put it off, that I had a bad situation on my hands, and I had to start dealing with it right away. I said that whatever I did, I didn't have to consult her before I did it, or listen to her line of bullshit, just because her husband had cut her once. I almost said he probably did it because she wouldn't shut up and go away and give him some peace. Can you believe that? But I was really pissed, Ralph. Hurting, confused, ashamed, but mostly just PO'd. I think that's probably a pretty normal reaction. She asked me how I'd feel about myself. Not about Ed, but about myself, if I went back into the relationship and Ed beat me up again. Then she asked how I'd feel if I went back in and Ed did it to Nat. That made me furious. It still makes me furious. Ed had never laid so much as a finger on her, and I said so." She nodded and said, "That doesn't mean he won't, Helen. I know you don't want to think about that, but you have to. Still, suppose you're right. Suppose he never so much as slaps her on the wrist. Do you want her to grow up watching him hit you? Do you want her to grow up seeing the things she saw today?" And that stopped me cold. I remembered how Ed looked when he came back in, how I knew as soon as I saw how white his face was, the way his head was moving, like a rooster, Ralph muttered. "What?" "Nothing. Go on." "I don't know what set him off. I never do anymore. But I knew he was going to start in on me. There's nothing he can do or say to stop it once he gets to a certain point. I ran for the bedroom, but he grabbed me by the hair. He pulled out a great big bunch of it. I screamed, and Natalie was sitting there in a high chair, sitting there watching us. And when I screamed, she screamed." Helen broke down then, crying hard. Ralph waited with his forehead leaning against the side of the doorway between the kitchen and the living room. He used the end of the dish towel he'd slung over his shoulder to wipe away his own tears, almost without thinking about it. "Anyway," Helen said when she was capable of speaking again, "I ended up talking to this woman for almost an hour. It's called victim counseling, and she does it for a living. Can you believe it?" "Yes," Ralph said, "I can." "It's a good thing, Helen." I'm going to see her again tomorrow at Woman Care. It's ironic, you know, that I should be going there. I mean, if I hadn't signed that petition... If it hadn't been the petition, it would have been something else. She sighed. Yes, I guess that might be true. Is true. Anyway, Gretchen says I can't solve Ed's problems, but I can start solving some of my own. Helen started to cry again, and then took a deep breath. I'm sorry. I've cried so much today, I never want to cry again. I told her I loved him. I felt ashamed to say it, and I'm not even sure it's true, but it feels true. I said I wanted to give him another chance. She said that meant I was committing Natalie to give him another chance, too. And that made me think of how she looked sitting there in the kitchen, with pureed spinach all over her face, screaming her head off while Ed hit me. God, I hate the way people like her drive you into a corner and won't let you out. She's trying to help, that's all. I hate that, too. I'm very confused, Ralph. Probably you didn't know that, but I am. A wan chuckle drifted down the telephone line. That's okay, Helen. It's natural for you to be confused. Just before she left, she told me about High Ridge. Right now, that sounds like just the place for me. What is it? A kind of halfway house. She kept explaining that it was a house, not a shelter, for battered women, which is what I guess I now officially am. This time the wan chuckle sounded perilously close to a sob. I can have Nat with me if I go, and that's a major part of the attraction. Where is this place? In the country, out toward Newport, I think. Yeah, I guess I knew that. Of course he did. Ham Davenport had told him during his woman care spiel. They're involved in family counseling, spouse and child abuse cases. They run a shelter for abused women over by the Newport town line. All at once, woman care seemed to be everywhere in his life. Ed would undoubtedly have seen sinister implications in this. That Gretchen Tilbury is one hard sugar bun, Helen was saying. Just before she left, she told me it was all right for me to love Ed. It has to be all right, she said, because love doesn't come out of a faucet you can turn on and off whenever you want to. But that I had to remember my love couldn't fix him, that not even Ed's love for Natalie could fix him, and that no amount of love changed my responsibility to take care of my child. I've been lying in bed thinking about that. I think I liked lying in bed and being mad better. It was certainly easier. Yes, he said, I can see how it might be. Helen, why don't you just take your pill and let it all go for a while? I will, but first I wanted to say thanks. You know, you don't have to do that. I don't think I know any such thing, she said, and Ralph was glad to hear the flash of emotion in her voice. It meant the essential Helen Deepnow was still there. I haven't quit being mad at you, Ralph, but I'm glad you didn't listen when I told you not to call the police. It's just that I was afraid, you know? Afraid. Helen, I... His voice was thick, close to cracking. He cleared his throat and tried again. I just didn't want to see you hurt any more than you already were. When I saw you coming across the parking lot with blood all over your face, I was just so afraid. Don't talk about that part. Please, I'll cry if you do. And I can't stand to cry any more. Okay. He had 1,000 questions about Ed, but this was clearly not the time to ask them. Can I come see you tomorrow? There was a short hesitation, and then Helen said, I don't think so. Not for a little while. I have a lot of thinking to do, a lot of things to sort out, and it's going to be hard. I'll be in touch, Ralph, okay? Of course, that's fine. What are you doing about the house? Candy's husband is going to go over and lock it up. I gave him my keys. Gretchen Tilbury said that Ed isn't supposed to go back for anything, not even his checkbook or a change of underwear. If there's stuff he needs, he gives a list and his house key to a policeman, and the policeman goes to get it. I suppose he'll go to Fresh Harbor. There's plenty of housing there for lab employees. These little cottages, they're actually sort of cute. The brief flash of fire he'd heard in her voice was long gone. Helen now sounded depressed. forlorn and very, very tired. Helen, I'm delighted that you called, and relieved. I won't kid you about that. Now get some sleep.
What about you, Ralph? She asked unexpectedly. Are you getting any sleep these days?
The switch in focus startled him into an honesty he might not otherwise have managed. Some, but maybe not as much as I need. Probably not as much as I need.
Well, take care of yourself. You were very brave today, like a knight in a story about King Arthur. But I think even Sir Lancelot had to fall out every now and then. He was touched by this, and also amused. A momentary picture, very vivid, arose in his mind.
Ralph Roberts, dressed in armor and mounted on a snow-white steed, while Bill McGovern, his faithful squire, rode behind him on his pony, dressed in a leather jerkin and his snappy Panama hat.
"Thank you, dear," he said. "I think that's the sweetest thing anyone said to me since Lyndon Johnson was president. Have the best night you can, okay?" "Okay. You too." She hung up. Ralph stood looking at the phone thoughtfully for a moment or two, then put it back in its cradle. Perhaps he would have a good night. After everything that had happened today, he certainly deserved one. For the time being, he thought he might go downstairs, sit on the porch, watch the sun go down, and let later take care of itself.
McGovern was back, slouched in his favorite chair on the porch. He was looking at something up the street and didn't immediately turn when his upstairs neighbor stepped outside. Ralph followed his gaze and saw a blue step van parked at the curb half a block up Harris Avenue, on the red apple side of the street. Derry Medical Services was printed across the rear doors in large white letters. "Hi, Bill," Ralph said, and dropped into his own chair. The rocker where Lois Chass always sat when she came over stood between them. A little twilight breeze had sprung up, delightfully cool after the heat of the afternoon, and the empty rocker moved lazily back and forth at its whim. "Hi," McGovern said, glancing over at Ralph. He started to look away, then did a double take.
"Man, you better start pinning up the bags under your eyes. You're going to be stepping on them pretty soon if you don't."
Ralph thought this was supposed to come out sounding like one of the caustic little bon mots for which McGovern was famous along the street. But the look in his eyes was one of genuine concern. "It's been a bitch of a day," he said. He told McGovern about Helen's call, editing out the things he thought she might be uncomfortable with McGovern knowing. Bill had never been one of her favorite people. "Glad she's okay," McGovern said.
"I'll tell you something, Ralph. You impressed me today, marching up the street that way like Gary Cooper in High Noon. Maybe it was insane, but it was also pretty cool." He paused. "To tell the truth, I was a little in awe of you." This was the second time in 15 minutes that someone had come close to calling Ralph a hero. It made him uncomfortable.
"I was too mad at him to realize how dumb I was being until later. Where you been, Bill? I tried to call you a little while ago." "I took a walk out to the extension," McGovern said. "Trying to cool my engine off a little, I guess. I felt headachy and sick to my stomach ever since Johnny Lydecker and that other one took Ed away." Ralph nodded. "Me too."
"Really?"
McGovern looked surprised and a little skeptical.
"Really?"
Ralph said with a faint smile. "Anyway, Faye Chapin was out at the picnic area where those old lags usually hang out during the hot weather, and he coaxed me into a game of chess. What a piece of work that guy is, Ralph. He thinks he's the reincarnation of Ruy Lopez, but he plays chess more like Soupy Sales, and he never shuts up."
"Faye's all right, though," Ralph said quietly.
McGovern seemed not to have heard him. "And that creepy Dorrance Marstella was out there," he went on. "If we're old, he's a fossil. He just stands there by the fence between the picnic area and the airport with a book of poetry in his hands, watching the planes take off and land. Does he really read those books he carries around, do you think? Or are they just props?"
Good question, Ralph said. But he was thinking about the word McGovern had used to describe Dorrance. Creepy. It wasn't one he would have used himself. But there could be no doubt that old Dor was one of life's originals. He wasn't senile. At least Ralph didn't think he was. It was more as if the few things he said were the product of a mind that was slightly skewed and perceptions that were slightly bent. He remembered that Dorrance had been there that day last summer when Ed ran into the guy in the pickup truck. At the time, he thought that Dorrance's arrival had added the final screwy touch to the festivities. And Dorrance had said something funny. Ralph tried to recall what it was and couldn't. McGovern was gazing back up the street, where a whistling young man in a gray coverall had just come out of the house in front of which the medical services step van was parked. This young man, looking all of 24, and as if he hadn't needed a single medical service in his entire life, was rolling a dolly with a long green tank strapped to it. "That's the empty," McGovern said. "You missed them taking in the full one." A second young man, also dressed in a coverall, stepped out through the front door of the small house, which combined yellow paint and deep pink trim in an unfortunate manner. He stood on the stoop for a moment, hand on the doorknob, apparently speaking to someone inside. Then he pulled the door shut and ran lithely down the walk. He was in time to help his colleague lift the dolly, with the tank still strapped to it, into the back of the van. "Oxygen?" Ralph asked. McGovern nodded. "For Mrs. Locker?" McGovern nodded again, watching as the medical services workers slammed the doors of the step van and then stood behind them, talking quietly in the fading light. "I went to grammar school and junior high with May Locker, way out in Cardville, home of the brave and land of the cows. There were only 5 of us in our graduating class. Back in those days, she was known as a hot ticket, and fellows like me were known as a wee bit lavender. In that amusingly antique era, gay was how you described your Christmas tree after it was decorated." Ralph looked down at his hands, uncomfortable and tongue-tied. Of course he knew that McGovern was a homosexual, had known it for years, but he had never spoken of it out loud until this evening. He wished Bill could have saved it for another day, preferably one when Ralph himself wasn't feeling as if most of his brains had been replaced with goose down. "That was about 1,000 years ago," McGovern said. "Who'd have thought we'd both wash up on the shores of Harris Avenue?" "It's emphysema she has, isn't that right?" "I think that's what I heard." "Yep. One of those diseases that keeps on giving. Getting old is certainly no job for sissies, is it?" "No, it's not," Ralph said. And then his mind brought the truth of it home with sudden force. It was Carolyn he thought of, and the terror he had felt when he came squelching into the apartment in his soaked Converse sneakers, and had seen her lying half in and half out of the kitchen, exactly where he had stood during most of his conversation with Helen, in fact. Facing Ed Deepnow had been nothing compared to the terror he had felt at that moment, when he had been sure Carolyn was dead. "I can remember when they just brought May oxygen once every 2 weeks or so," McGovern said. "Now they come every Tuesday and Thursday evening, like clockwork. I go over and see her when I can. Sometimes I read to her the most boring women's magazine bullshit you can imagine. And sometimes we just sit and talk. She says it feels as if her lungs are filling up with seaweed. It won't be long now. They'll come one day, and instead of loading an empty oxy tank into the back of that wagon, they'll load May in. They'll take her off to Derry Home, and that'll be the end." "Was it cigarettes?" Ralph asked. McGovern favored him with a look so alien to that lean, mild face that it took Ralph several moments to realize it was contempt. "May Perrault never smoked a cigarette in her whole life. What she's paying off is 20 years in the dye house at a mill in Carina and another 20 working the picker at a mill in Newport. It's cotton, wool, and nylon she's trying to breathe through, not seaweed." The two young men from Derry Medical Services got into their van and drove away. "Maine's the northeastern anchor of Appalachia, Ralph. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's true. And May's dying of an Appalachian disease. The doctors call it textile lung." That's a shame. I guess she means a lot to you.
McGovern laughed ruefully. Nah, I visit her because she happens to be the last visible piece of my misspent youth. Sometimes I read to her, and I always manage to get down one or two of her dry old oatmeal cookies. But that's about as far as it goes. My concern is safely selfish, I assure you.
Safely selfish, Ralph thought? What a really odd phrase. What a really McGovern phrase.
Never mind May, McGovern said. The question on the lips of Americans everywhere is what we're going to do about you, Ralph. The whiskey didn't work, did it?
No, Ralph said. I'm afraid it didn't.
To make a particularly apropos pun, did you give it a fair shot?
Ralph nodded.
Well, you have to do something about the bags under your eyes, or you'll never land the lovely Lois.
McGovern studied Ralph's facial response to this and sighed.
Not that funny, huh?
Nope. It's been a long day.
Sorry.
It's okay.
They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching the comings and goings on their part of Harris Avenue. Three little girls were playing hopscotch in the Red Apples parking lot across the street. Mrs. Perrine stood nearby, straight as a sentry, watching them. A boy with his Red Sox cap turned around backward went past, bopping to the beat of his Walkman headset. Two kids were tossing a frisbee back and forth in front of Lois's house. A dog barked. Somewhere a woman was yelling for Sam to get his sister and come inside. It was just the usual street life serenade, no more and no less. But to Ralph it all seemed strangely false. He supposed it was because he'd gotten so used to seeing Harris Avenue empty lately. He turned to McGovern and said, "You know what was just about the first thing I thought of when I saw you in the Red Apple parking lot this afternoon? In spite of everything else that was going on?" McGovern shook his head. "I wondered where the hell your hat was. The Panama. You looked very strange to me without it. Naked almost.
So come clean. Where did you stash the lid, son?"
McGovern touched the top of his head, where the remaining strands of his baby-fine white hair were combed carefully left to right across his pink skull. "I don't know," he said. "I missed it this morning. I almost always remember to drop it on the table by the front door when I come in. But it's not there. I suppose I put it down somewhere else this time, and the exact locale has slipped my mind for the nonce. Give me another few years, and I'll be wandering around in my underwear because I can't remember where I left my pants. All part of the wonderful aging experience. Right, Ralph?"
Ralph nodded and smiled, thinking to himself that of all the elderly people he knew, and he knew at least three dozen on a casual walk in the park, "Hi, how you doing?" basis, Bill McGovern bitched the most about getting on in years. He seemed to regard his vanished youth and recently departed middle age as a general would regard a couple of soldiers who desert on the eve of a big battle. He wasn't about to say such a thing, however. Everyone had their little eccentricities. Being theatrically morbid about growing old was simply one of McGovern's.
"Did I say something funny?" McGovern asked.
"Pardon?"
"You were smiling, so I thought I must have said something funny." He sounded a bit touchy, especially for a man so fond of ribbing his upstairs neighbor about the pretty widow down the street. But Ralph reminded himself it had been a long day for McGovern, too.
"I wasn't thinking about you at all," Ralph said. "I was thinking about how Carolyn used to say practically the same thing, that getting old was like getting a bad dessert at the end of a really fine meal." This was at least half a lie. Carolyn had made the metaphor, but she had used it to describe the brain tumor that was killing her, not her life as a senior citizen. She hadn't been all that senior anyway, just 64 when she died. And until the last 6 or 8 weeks of her life, she'd claimed to feel only half of that on most days. Across the street, the three girls who had been playing hopscotch approached the curb, looked both ways for traffic, then joined hands and ran across the street, laughing. For just a moment, they looked to him as if they were surrounded by a gray glow, a nimbus that illuminated their cheeks and brows and laughing eyes like some strange, clarifying St. Elmo's fire. A little frightened, Ralph squeezed his eyes shut and then popped them open again. The gray envelope he'd imagined around the trio of girls was gone, which was a relief. But he had to get some sleep soon. He had to. Ralph? McGovern's voice seemed to be coming from the far end of the porch, although he hadn't moved. You all right?
Sure, Ralph said. Thinking about Ed and Helen, that's all.
Did you have any idea how screwy he was getting, Bill?
McGovern shook his head decisively. None whatsoever, he said. And although I saw bruises on Helen from time to time, I always believed her stories about them. I don't like to think of myself as a tremendously gullible person, but I may have to reassess my thinking on that score. What do you think will happen with them? Any predictions?
McGovern sighed and touched the top of his head with his fingertips, feeling for the missing Panama without realizing it.
You know me, Ralph. I'm a cynic from a long line of them. I think it's very rare for ordinary human conflicts to resolve themselves the way they do on TV. In reality, they just keep coming back, turning in diminishing circles, until they finally disappear. Except disappearing isn't really what they do. They dry up, like mud puddles in the sun.
McGovern paused and then added, and most of them leave the same scummy residue behind.
Jesus, Ralph said, that is cynical.
McGovern shrugged. Most retired teachers are cynical, Ralph. We see them come in so young and so strong, so convinced that it's going to be different for them, and we see them make their messes and then paddle around in them, just as their parents and grandparents did. What I think is that Helen will go back to him, and Ed will do okay for a while, and then he'll beat her up again, and she'll leave again. It's like one of those sappy country western songs they have on the juke out at Nicky's lunch, and some people have to listen to that song a long, long time before they decide they don't want to hear it anymore. Helen's a bright young woman, though. I think one more verse is all she'll need.
One more verse might be all she'll ever get, Ralph said quietly.
We're not talking about some drunk husband coming home on Friday night and beating his wife up because he lost his paycheck in a poker game, and she dared to bitch about it.
I know, McGovern said, but you asked for my opinion and I gave it to you. I think Helen's going to need one more verse on the jukebox before she can bring herself to call it off. And even then, they're apt to keep on bumping up against each other. It's still a pretty small town.
He paused, squinting down the street.
Oh, look, he said, hoisting his left brow. Our Lois, she walks in beauty like the night.
Ralph gave him an impatient look, which McGovern either did not see or pretended not to. He got up, once again touching the tips of his fingers to the place where the Panama wasn't, and then went down the steps to meet her on the walk.
Lois, McGovern cried, dropping on one knee before her and extending his hands theatrically. Would that our lives might be united by the starry bonds of love. Wed your fate to mine, and let me whirl you away to climes various in the golden car of my affections.
Gee, are you talking about a honeymoon or a one-night stand? Lois asked, smiling uncertainly. Ralph poked McGovern in the back. Get up, fool, he said, and took the small bag Lois was carrying. He looked inside and saw three cans of beer. McGovern got to his feet.
Sorry, Lois, he said. It was a combination of summer twilight and your beauty. I plead temporary insanity, in other words.
Lois smiled at him, then turned to Ralph.
I just heard what happened, she said, and I hurried over as fast as I could. I was in Ludlow all afternoon, playing nickel-dime poker with the girls.
Ralph didn't have to look at McGovern to know that his left eyebrow, the one that said, poker with the girls, how wonderfully, typically, perfectly our Lois, would be hoisted to its maximum altitude.
Is Helen all right?
Yes, Ralph said. Well, maybe not exactly all right. They're keeping her in the hospital overnight. But she's not in any danger.
And the baby?
Fine. Staying with a friend of Helen's. Well, come on up on the porch, you two, and tell me all about it. She linked one arm through McGovern's, the other through Ralph's, and led them back up the walk. They mounted the porch steps that way, like two elderly musketeers,
with a woman whose affections they had vied for in the days of their youth held safely between them. And as Lois sat down in her rocking chair, the street lights went on along Harris Avenue, glimmering in the dusk like a double rope of pearls. Ralph fell asleep that night, bare instants after his head hit the pillow, and came wide awake again at 3:30 a.m. on Friday morning. He knew immediately there was no question of going back to sleep. He might as well proceed directly to the wing chair in the living room. He lay there a moment longer anyway, looking up into the dark and trying to catch the tail of the dream he'd been having. He couldn't do it. He could only remember that Ed had been in it, and Helen, and Rosalie, the dog he sometimes saw limping up or down Harris Avenue before Pat the paperboy showed up. Dorrance was in it, too. Dorrance Marsteller. Don't forget him. And as if a key had turned in a lock, Ralph suddenly remembered the strange thing Dorrance had said during the confrontation between Ed and the heavyset man last year. The thing Ralph hadn't been able to remember earlier this evening when McGovern brought the old man's name up. He'd been holding Ed back, trying to keep him pinned against the bent hood of his car long enough for reason to reassert itself. And Dorrance had said, "I wouldn't," that Ralph ought to stop touching him. "He said he couldn't see my hands anymore," Ralph muttered, swinging his feet out of the bed. That was it. He sat where he was for a little while, head down, hair frizzed up wildly in back, his fingers laced loosely together between his thighs. At last he stepped into his slippers and shuffled into the living room. It was time to start waiting for the sun to come up.